You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hi, this is Phil Rogers, MLB.com Extras, NL Central Edition. Two very strong September teams out of the Central in the Cardinals and the Pirates, both led by the front of their rotations. Adam Wainwright knocking down his 20th win, and both Gerrit Cole and Francisco Liriano getting hot to get the Pirates into the playoffs. Going to be very interesting to see. Would not be surprising to see either of those teams in the World Series. Very interesting division in 2014, and looking forward to 15. As always, joined by Jen Langosch, Cardinals beat writer. And, Jen, we're talking about a Cardinals team that wrapped up a return trip to the playoffs by, I think, playing their best baseball in September. But when you look back at the season, you know, I think it's remarkable for the lack of highs and lows before September, that it was just steady, over 500 every month. I know a lot of people just kept waiting for the Cardinals to put together the big run that they did by winning 16 of 21 in a stretch in September to wrap up a playoff spot. But the consistency of this team, that has to kind of stick out if you think back to Jupiter, Florida, and over the whole season.
Yeah, no, you make a good point. I mean, even though for the first 5 months of the season, the Cardinals really never had a long winning streak or the same period where they won 8 out of 10, 10 out of 13 or so, they also never lost too many in a row. I mean, this is a team that hasn't lost more than 4 in a row at any point this season, and that ability to kind of minimize the lows allowed them to tread water while they were playing around 500 or just slightly above. And then, as you mentioned, they've had a very strong September, which has kind of been the mark of this organization the last 4 years in getting them to the playoffs. So, yeah, they treaded water in a way that the team like Milwaukee more recently did not. You know, the Cardinals were able to avoid that kind of slump. And I do think they're playing their best baseball as of late. I mean, certainly there are still concerns about this offense and how much, you know, run production it can offer. That being said, with the way the starting pitching is held up, and particularly held up down the stretch, you have to like the chances of at least the Cardinals being in games. If the offense can come alive, certainly that puts them in a good position going into October.
Well, I know something that every Cardinal fan enjoyed was watching Adam Wainwright knock down his 20th win, second time in his career. He's won 20, joining the likes of Bob Gibson and Joaquin Andujar as the only Cardinals pitchers in the last 65 years with multiple 20-win seasons. Had an unbelievable career, 4 times in the last 5 years in the top 3 in Cy Young voting, or 4 times in 6 years, but 4 times in 5 when he's been healthy, top 3 in Cy Young voting, but he can't get the Cy Young. I would suggest he's kind of playing Phil Mickelson to Clayton Kershaw's Tiger Woods. Do you think how much really is there to a Wainwright-Kershaw rivalry? And do you think Kershaw really is kind of motivating Wainwright? You know, he's talked about off-season workouts. He thinks about what is Kershaw doing. How do you look at that pair of pitchers?
Yeah, no, I think that's a very real thing. It's interesting, you know, Wainwright, obviously I know Adam pretty well from covering him a lot better than I would know Clayton Kershaw. From what I've heard, the two are very similar in terms of their off-the-field efforts, a lot of charity work, religious backgrounds, this and that, and they've actually become very good friends off the field through a lot of those charitable endeavors. So it's interesting that they have a personal relationship that I think has also translated into a professional pushing of each other. And, yeah, I mean, Adam sets his sights on Clayton, and you know, certainly it's unfortunate timing for him that the peak of his career, you know, intersects with the peak of Clayton Kershaw's career. And you mentioned the Cy Young Award, the lack of that, you know, just the poor timing of it. But yeah, I mean, Adam does think about Clayton, does think about trying to one-up him. It is a source of motivation. But like I said, I think it's a very friendly sort of thing because they get along so well off the field and they're so similar. You know, we talked about it last week. You brought up the possibility of a Clayton Kershaw-Adam Wainwright matchup in the postseason. You know, as we sit here a couple of days from finding out the eventual pairings, that's looking pretty likely. I mean, how awesome potentially twice in a 5-game series to see those two go head-to-head. I think it will bring out the best of both of them. I know Will and Wainwright, those are stages he likes to elevate himself onto. You know, and even if he can't win the Cy Young Award this year, if he can pitch this team past Clayton Kershaw and past the Dodgers, if that is who they play, I think he'll take that over a Cy Young Award.
Oh, I can't imagine what television ratings will be for a division series game if you get those matchups, because I think two guys that baseball fans really appreciate the legacies that they are creating, and the head-to-head would be unbelievable. Looking at Wainwright down the stretch, you know, you also think in this postseason run, you're going to get the best Adam Wainwright can offer. 5-0, 1.38 in September, only allowed six runs, period, earned or otherwise, in 39 innings. And I was at Wrigley Field when he won 20 and was talking about it had been a battle over that eight-start stretch after the All-Star break when he didn't have his best to find his feel and to get – when he talks about that, is he really talking about to be right on top of his curveball as much as anything? I mean, that seems to be the weapon when you talk to other hitters. It's like you know it's going to – you know if you lay off it, it'll fall out of a strike zone, but it starts out looking like it's got too much of a strike zone. You just can't lay off it. Is it the curveball more than anything when he talks about the feel?
Yeah, I mean, to some extent, you know, what he was going through in August actually was a variation of all sorts of things. I mean, there was one start where he talked about the delivery, just not being able to have a repeatable in-sync delivery. And the next start, it would be the fastball command, you know. And that curveball is always going to be effective, but it's going to be even more effective if the fastball is working. And there was a stretch of starts there where Adam didn't have his fastball, and then that made him more susceptible to even having the curve hit. So, you know, it was a period of time where you know, he talked about a dead arm phase, so I think the strength wasn't there. But there were also a lot of questions about whether or not the workload that he's carried over the last year and a half up to that point was catching up with him. So the way that he has closed out, I mean, he's 5-0 this month, has a chance to potentially win a sixth game if he stays on turn and pitches this weekend. I mean, the way he has closed this out, he is pitching as he did in April, May, and June when he had a sub-2 ERA and was averaging close to eight innings a start. And, you know, as you look at Adam Wainwright's career and all that he has accomplished during the regular season, the win totals, the complete games of shutouts, those lists that he's high on, the one thing that his resume does lack is stepping up in the postseason and having some postseason stardom. Obviously, we saw him do it as a closer, as a rookie, but when you look at him as a starting pitcher, he was out in 2011 for that run. He struggled in 2012 when he was worn down from being back for the first year post-surgery. You know, and last year he gets beat twice in the World Series. So, you know, I think that is one area that he looks at that he knows he hasn't really proven himself on that stage yet. And, you know, for Adam Wainwright, any motivation makes him that much more dangerous of a pitcher.
Yeah, looking at the lineup, Jen, you know, one guy that to me has been April to September probably the steadiest and maybe the biggest contribution to the lineup, although I don't think you see him at the top of any any league leader list. But Matt Carpenter, I stumbled across this stat the other day. He's reached base 260 times as we speak on either hits or walks, and there's only five guys in the major leagues that have done that more often: Jose Bautista, Freddie Freeman, Mike Trout, and the brilliant Jose Altuve of the Astros. As Carpenter very quietly had a very good season, similar to his 2013 kind of breakout?
Yeah, I mean, when you look at his numbers this year to last year, I mean, his numbers last year were going to be hard to live up to when you talk about the 55 doubles, hitting well over 300, the on-base percentage, your runs scored, he had 199 hits, those things. You know, he's not going to necessarily match the numbers that he did last year, but he is going to probably end the year leading the National League in walks. As you mentioned, on-base percentage going to be right up there at the top. And, you know, it's been, you know, no secret that when Matt Carpenter gets on base, this offense clicks. You know, there are numbers to back that up. For whatever reason, if he can get on in front of, you know, a John Jay, a Matt Holliday, a Matt Adams, you know, this team scores. So, yeah, I mean, he's had a good year. Again, it hasn't really been the standout year that he had last year, and I think, you know, there's still some maybe that on-base percentage and getting on base with walks or hit by pitch or whatever may not be the sexy way to go about it. But he is getting on base. I think he did go through a period here the last couple weeks where fatigue set in a little bit. I mean, this is a guy that is the first to arrive at the ballpark and oftentimes the last to leave, and, you know, all the work that he puts in certainly has gotten him to this point and made him the player that he is. But it also gets you to the point where at this time of year, you do start to tire. And he has taken off a few more days recently. I think that's helped rejuvenate him. So, yeah, if the Cardinals' offense is clicking, it's usually because Matt Carpenter is getting on base. And so when you look at this team into October. I think that's one of the biggest keys for this offense to get going.
Yeah, I know after the Alan Craig trade, there was much talk about the role that would create for Oscar Tavares, and he's had a fine September. Looking at it, he's hit .333 in September, has an .813 OPS. But a guy that's gotten just as much playing time and done a tick better, Randall Grichuk, hitting .378 in September with an OPS of 1.043. Is he making the Cardinals think harder about finding a bigger role for him, whether it's in on a postseason roster or for 2015?
Yeah, I think for both. I mean, when we look at Randall, it's been interesting, Kath. I mean, he was here earlier this summer, didn't fare all that well in his first try. And really, I mean, he was going to be up here in September. He got called up a little bit earlier because of an injury to Shane Robinson, which was, you know, an opportune time for him. When he was brought up, the thought was, okay, this is a guy that has hit left-handers extremely well in the minors. Let's look at a platoon situation. That's how it started. He continued to hit lefties so well that it got to the point where now he's also making starts against right-handed pitchers and also doing okay in that regard. So, you know, I think what the Cardinals have is a situation where they have three outfielders in Grichuk, Tavares, and Borges, where Mike Matheny can really play to the matchups on any given day and really try to maximize what he has in the outfield. Where we stand now, though, I don't see any scenario in which Randall Grichuk, you know, regular season or postseason, isn't starting against lefties. And again, I think you do have to give him strong consideration even against right-handed pitching. Not only do you get his bat in there, which has proven itself in September, but defensively, he makes that outfield defense a notch better. And what we've seen from him just in the short time, very superb defender, above average runner, has the power, just a really intriguing guy to put into a lineup that, again, has lacked production throughout the year. And, you know, when you talk about Tavares also having a good month, I think it's because Mike Matheny has been able to pick and choose his spots to play Tavares and really has put him in a position to succeed, which is the benefit of having three guys, again, that you can kind of rotate in and out of that right field spot.
Okay, Jen, one last thing. Since it's my job to look down the road and to get caught up and get ahead of myself, you're right, last week we did talk about Kershaw Wainwright. But as I look at the whole postseason landscape, I see something else, and that's the Angels as a strong American League team. The Cardinals, I think, one of the top three, you can't argue anything past that, top National League teams. And what about an Albert Pujols versus Wainwright World Series matchup? How would that play in St. Louis?
Wouldn't that be something? You know, and you can't forget David Freese either. I mean, imagine his hometown homecoming being in the World Series. You know, you're not the first person in St. Louis that's mentioned that. Goodness, I think St. Louis would be thrilled if the Cardinals could just get to the World Series, and certainly if that was the matchup. It would be, A, intriguing to see how Albert is welcomed back in St. Louis. I think it would be pretty fondly at this point. Certainly, I think David Freese would be welcomed with open arms by the community. They still loved him. But, yeah, when you talk about storylines, an Angels-Cardinals World Series would be full. It'd be fun. It would absolutely be fun.
Well, that's a great thing about October baseball. Crazy things do happen, and that big stage gets crowded with good storylines. For Jim Langosch, this is Phil Rogers. This has been MLB.com Extras, St. Louis Cardinals edition. As always, I'll be joined by Tom Singer, Pittsburgh Pirates beat writer and native of the city of Pittsburgh. And we're talking about a Pirates team that is going back to the playoffs, back-to-back trips to the playoffs. And, Tom, just wondering, what's the feeling like with the Pirates this year as compared to last year? Is there any kind of a different mindset as they look forward to the postseason run than there was last year, when it seemed like there was a little more drama getting there, and certainly ending that long postseason streak was a big deal?
Yeah, that was such a huge overriding part of this thing last season. You know, they kind of got it together. They didn't stop immediately. They went into the NLDS. But this season, October, there's a definite sense that, you know, they want to finish what they started last year. I was amazed how subdued the celebration was on the field after the game. Now, they kind of let it rip in the clubhouse afterwards, but the post-game reaction was, you know, your basic handshake, victory line, and nothing else. And in the clubhouse, you know, some of the team veterans, did note that this feels like business as usual. Last year was such a emotional breakthrough, but this year it's business as usual, and they don't intend to close down the business until deep into the playoffs.
Yeah, and when I look at what the Pirates have done this year to get back to the playoffs, the thing that strikes me is just kind of how long they treaded water. I mean, they were in fifth place in the wild card race at the All-Star break, but only three games back. And that deficit never got bigger than that. But they, just seemed like forever, they were right there on the verge of being in position for one of those two wild card spots. But it kind of took that run of 15 of 18, winning 15 of 18, in September to get over the top. Was there ever a sense around the Pirates that it was a big crisis, or was it kind of some quiet confidence coming from Clint Hurdle that it was going to click at some point?
Definitely quiet confidence. The interesting dynamic of that time when they were treading water, as you put it, the perception was that they were fortunate to even be in that position. They did not look like a postseason threat. The offense was too erratic. The back of the bullpen was way too porous. I don't know if you remember, they came to Chicago after being swept in St. Louis, and Hurdle was asked, what the chances are for this team to turn around and make a run, and I remember exactly what he said: if we play our kind of ball, we'll get in. They've kind of played a little bit above even their, anybody's kind of ball, 15 out of 18. But they've certainly made it in. They bolstered the bullpen. I think they were helped by the fact, when rosters expanded, they didn't overload, but whatever they added was in the bullpen. And even the relievers that do not figure to be postseason pieces kind of gave the other guys a blow, so when you needed to shut down games, they were rested. I think that made the biggest difference of all.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that series at Wrigley Field early September, going back to that, which really started the run of winning 15 out of 18 to wrap up the playoff spot. The first of those games, as I know you remember, was that crazy suspended game, tied 3-3 in the seventh inning. Had to come back and play the next day, and the Pirates would win it in 11 innings. Josh Harrison drove in a run and then made a really good catch over his shoulder, falling down in the bottom of the inning, and John Holmstrom making only his second career big league appearance, came in and nailed down that save. And then Liriano pitched well in the regularly scheduled game, and they essentially wound up winning a doubleheader that day, 5-3 in the first game and 5-0 in the second game. Is it fair to point to that series and say, maybe it was the rosters expanding and maybe it was the backlash of having lost that been swept in St. Louis? You look at the series in St. Louis, those were all games that could have gone either way, and they just went the Cardinals' way, not the Pirates. But was there anything in that run that really kind of ignited the Pirates?
Well, in retrospect, absolutely. And also, past experience had a lot to do with it. Last season, they had the identical experience. They got swept badly in St. Louis, and they looked kind of dead. They went to Texas. Last season's Rangers, obviously, a lot more formidable team than this season's version. But anyway, they went to Texas and they swept the Rangers. So I think having gone through a similar experience last season kind of gave him that kind of relaxed them coming out of St. Louis this time. And in a sense, that history has repeated because they picked it right back up again.
Yeah, and one thing, the win in Atlanta that clinched the playoff, Gerrit Cole, who Francisco Liriano, I think, has been a real key to this September, gave up a run in the first inning, a run in the second inning, and watching the game, he just looked angry. And then there was nothing he gave up the rest of the game. Would you agree that like when things go bad or he gets his back up, he just seems angry, and it's like, get out of my way, I'm taking it from here.
That's totally correct. You don't want to get in his way when he's in that mood. And as long as you brought up Cole, obviously he was dominant after that second inning last night. He was also responsible for that turnaround last season that I alluded to. You know, when they went into Texas, he beat Yu Darvish 1-0. So that was their turnaround game last season. Last night obviously wasn't a turnaround game, but it was definitely a iconic clinching game. Cole dealt with some, I don't think it was a blister, I think it was just a routine cut on his finger. I'm not sure where he got it from, but he had a bloody uniform by the time the game ended. But obviously it didn't affect his pitching. But I think, you know, that's part of it. He just gets focused on what he has to do on the mound and doesn't let anything, even a little blood, get in the way. At the very least, when you see a pitcher dealing with some kind of bloody issue, at least you'll see the trainer go out and, you know, treat it, whatever. And we never saw anybody even visit Cole in the mound. It's a little bit like Bob Gibson. You know, they used to say, you know, even if you're catching him, you don't want to go to the mound because Gibson will, you know, glare you back to behind the plate. And Cole has that kind of mentality as a Bob Gibson.
Yeah, I think you're totally right about that. You know, I was watching him. He was, like, shaking his hand between pitches. And, you know, I thought about a blister or maybe a finger that was numb. But he definitely had that, I don't need anybody else's help with this. This is like just a paper cut, you know, please stay away. No problems here. And you look at last year's NLDS, you know, I think maybe nationally when people thought the story of the Pirates was that they made the playoffs and won that wild card game. But to me, they were so close to beating the Cardinals in that division series, the Cardinals team that went to the World Series. They just ran into Adam Wainwright's curveball, and you saw Gerrit Cole get pushed to be given that Game 5 start. Do you think that is a motivator, too, for Cole, that he wants to be in that situation again, kind of a Game 5 big moment mulligan?
Oh, absolutely. And although the final in the Game 5 was 6-1, don't forget, Cole only gave up two runs. He made one bad pitch. David Freese hit a two-run homer against him. But, I mean, definitely he wants to be back in that situation. And the Pirates kind of have learned a little bit from that, too. The big game of that series was the 2-1 loss in Pittsburgh to Walker. If they win that game, obviously they avoid having to see, you know, Wainwright. So I think that's another thing going into this postseason. They'll pace each game with a little bit more urgency. You know, you don't concede that there's always a tomorrow, because tomorrow may bring somebody like Adam Wainwright and you want to avoid him. And I think that actually might influence how Clint Hurdle manages this time around.
Well, it's going to be a lot of fun for all of us to see. I know that the Pirates were great to cover in the playoffs last year, and know they're going to be that way again. And great baseball city. I think everybody likes to see postseason games at PNC. And just really looking forward to the Pirates in the postseason now that it's official. So for Tom Singer, this is Phil Rogers, Pittsburgh Pirates edition of MLB.com Extras. Thanks for listening. As always, we'll be joined by Adam McKelvey, Brewers beat writer for MLB.com. And we're talking about one of the most schizophrenic franchises in Major League Baseball for 2014. Adam, I know you know it as well as anybody, but let me give you some numbers that I think really illustrate it. That the high point of 51-32 start, that's 614 baseball. They were on pace to win 99 games. After that, between that and when they were eliminated from the wild card race, a stretch of 29-45, that's 392 baseball, and if you play that out, that's a team that loses 99 games. So the biggest, you know, when you look at that, what was the biggest difference? What was the biggest change first half to the second half?
Well, it's unfair to blame it on any one facet, first of all. This is a team-wide collapse, and every area shares blame. But the numbers that stand out to me as I was looking at it the other day are the offense. This went from the second-best offensive team in the National League the best offense below 5,000 feet, I like to say, in the National League, to the third worst scoring offense in the second half. And I'm not talking about post-All-Star break. I'm giving them the start of July as well. So for 3 months, they were second best. They scored a bunch of runs. They were second in homers, second in slugging, OPS, all the categories. And it fell off a cliff. And figuring out why is going to be the big task for Doug Melvin and his staff this offseason, because they did not suffer a debilitating injury. You know, the Reds lost Joey Votto, for example. You can hang your hat on that to some degree. The Brewers had guys go on the DL, but not for extended periods. Yet the offense completely collapsed. So they've got a lot to figure out. And like I say, we can't blame it solely on the hitters, because when they went in their 3-16 stretch that really ruined the Brewers' season, the starting pitching was terrible too. And they were playing from behind every day, and that makes it really hard on an offensive club. But, again, you look at the larger picture, and this is a club that swings a lot. They swing early, and early in the season that worked for them, down the stretch that did not work. And Ron Arnicki is talking a little bit about, you know, maybe they need to drive in a different philosophy with some guys for next season. You can't completely change a hitter, but you can ask them to be a little bit better in some areas, and I think that's what they're going to have to do.
Well, when you talked about a team that fell off, and I, you know, you can say, and I think it's fair, you know, who picked the Brewers to win when we were in Arizona and Florida in spring training? They weren't a front runner with many people, but on the other hand, they did make that late signing for Matt Garza, pushed the payroll up above $100 million for the first time in franchise history, and, you know, have it unravel like this. How much fallout do you think there will be from this collapse? And at the ownership level down, I mean, do you see this as a thing that could cost some people in the organization jobs?
Yeah, I do. It's very hard to tell. This is a team with a very aggressive owner. You know, 2008, they fired Ned Yost with 12 games to go, and a team that ended up winning the wild card and making the postseason for the first time in 26 years had an interim manager. So I think that experience has made us believe in Milwaukee that you never know exactly what the fallout is going to be. You know, sometimes that can be unfair. Coaches take the fall for players' struggles. You know, it's Ron Renicki and Johnny Nairn, their hitting coach. I don't think their batting averages were a problem in the second half, but sometimes – you know, you have to show the fans that there's accountability. So that is something we're kind of keeping an eye on here. Now I'll say this about Ron Renicki. I think that he is a good fit for the personnel that they have on this team. He's one of those guys that kind of lets the players play. He's not a manager that's going to criticize the players. He's the anti-Bobby Valentine. I think it suits the players in that clubhouse well. That's just my view from the outside. Now, others who have a more inside view might look at that differently. But I don't think that if I'm looking at it from a logical perspective, I can't point at different things and say this was Ron Renicki's fault, that was Ron Renicki's fault. I see the logic in his bullpen moves. Would it be a little unfair if he's a fall guy? I mean, I think you can build that argument.
Yeah, and no question. I think that's often the case with managers. Really hard to evaluate unless you get the extremely good or the extremely not so good. And really, most guys fall into the gray area. And you know, you judge a guy off of his day-to-day presence. And I mean, certainly Ron Renicki. I mean, to me, very much cut from that Mike Socia Angels cloth. And you know, you look at the Angels and you see the stability that they have had, and now they're rolling back and on an upcycle again, coming off a really bad cycle themselves. But looking beyond the management personnel, looking at the upcoming off season, you know, it seems like there's some player decisions to be made. I don't know if they're obvious or not. Aramis Ramirez has this $14 million mutual option. And I think the expectation is will hit the free agent market and turn down his own end of it. Is that how you think that'll play out, Adam?
I think that's probably the most likely. You know, this came up a couple of weeks ago, and Doug Melvin made clear they haven't even talked about that yet. They were focused on trying to make the postseason.
But I think it is likely that the Brewers will exercise that. They don't have an obvious guy in the system that they could plug in there. They would have to go out and get somebody. And, you know, then if Aramis Rivera declines, the Brewers would be off the hook for, I think it's a $4 million buyout. And then they could address third base otherwise, including potentially signing him to a multi-year deal, because he's going to be one of the best two or three free agent third basemen out there, even at 36. And I don't blame him for wanting to potentially explore whether he can get a multi-year deal. So I think he is definitely in play for this team. And the other place is first base. This will be the second straight season the Brewers are last in the National League in OPS from first base. They have just been unable to fill that position since Prince Fielder left. And that's another spot where, well, they have a couple of players. They don't have an obvious guy to step in there. They thought it was going to be a prospect, Hunter Morris. He's had two straight years of kind of spinning his wheels. He missed time this year with a broken arm. They have Matt Clark, who was a September call-up and has been pretty impressive for this team. He's bounced around from the Padres to the Mets and then signed with the Brewers when Morris was hurt. He's right now, internally, the most likely guy to play first base for the Brewers next year. But I think that, you know, there'd be big question marks on what exactly he would be if he would be an everyday big leaguer. So those two corner infield spots are the big questions. If you look elsewhere around that Brewers diamond, this team's coming back, and they're solid up the middle. Doug Melvin likes to point out that they have young, controllable, really good players at catcher, center field, you know, second base with Scooter Gennett, and they'll hope for a bounce back from their shortstop, Gene Segura. They think he's a way better hitter than he showed this year. And with those positions filled, I think the franchise feels okay about being able to make a couple additions. Their starting pitching is all back, and being a pretty good team again next year. And maybe, you know, as you said, Phil, I don't know how many people had the Brewers leading the NL Central for 150 days this season. I think maybe next season people were more intrigued by them, with Chris Davis, the left fielder, having a year under his belt, with Scooter Gennett having a full year under his belt. Now you kind of have a little more experience around their other core guys, and maybe next year was going to be their year all along. They just happened to surprise really early and put themselves in this position to see it all slip away in the second half.
Hey, one other guy I want to ask you about, and Ricky Weeks, there's an option in his contract. I think, you know, clearly with Scooter Gennett playing the way he has, Ricky Weeks' health on and off the last few years, seems like a foregone conclusion that the end of this year is going to be the end of Ricky Weeks' long run with the Brewers. When you look at his legacy, what really stands out to you?
Injuries. You know, and he never lived up to the expectations that the fans and people in Milwaukee had for him. I don't think he gets enough credit for being a solid player. He's on a list of a dozen players to get 1,000 hits for the Brewers, and when you look at the list, it's a pretty good list. So he is a better player, I think, than people give him credit for, but he is a lesser player than the people here were hoping he was going to end up being as a second overall pick in the draft. And a lot of that is injuries. Hand injuries early in his career really hurt him. The other thing that hurt him is, you know, frankly, a little bit of stubbornness in terms of what he did at the plate. He's got that bat waggle for a long time. A lot of different first coaches talked to him about adjusting that in order to be a better hitter, more consistent major league hitter. He was not willing or able to do that. And you wonder whether it hurt him. So it's a mixed legacy, but again, I think the way I'll remember him is a really good player for this team for, in the context of today's game, a really long time. And I wish more people would think of him that way.
Yeah, he was always very popular with those fantasy league drafts. I know everybody, every year you'd keep expecting a big season from Ricky Weeks, and he getting on the field to fulfill it, always a problem. But Adam, never a problem for you to get out here for the MLB.com Extras podcast. We appreciate it. I'm joined by Mark Sheldon, beat writer for the Reds, talking about a team that just couldn't get it going in the second half of the season with no Johnny Votto. Let me start again. Kind of a combination of Johnny Cueto, Joey Votto. Sorry,
Johnny
Mike.
Votto.
That guy would be formidable.
Yeah, he would be. That's right. It'd be Babe Ruth. Well, if he was healthy. Hi, this is Phil Rogers, MLB.com Extra Cincinnati Reds Edition. As always, I'm joined by Mark Sheldon, Reds beat writer, talking about a team that just couldn't get it going in the second half of the year. Missed Joey Votto. the starting rotation that looked so formidable coming out of spring training. It never really got it rolling from top to bottom. But we did see from the ace, Johnny Cueto, a vintage season. And, Mark, let's start with Cueto. Was there anything that you could point to as a key for him to be so wire-to-wire? Was it just that he had finally gotten over the shoulder and was back to being confident about his health?
I think it's exactly that. I think his health was a huge issue last year. He only had 12 starts. He was, going back to the playoffs in 2012 with the oblique and then going into the bicep or tricep strain that he was dealing with last season. He just wasn't Johnny Cueto. And, you know, you saw what he was capable of in 2012 right up until the playoff game that knocked him out and eight pitches in. And really, this season's kind of a continuation of that. If you kind of erase 2013, 2014 picked up right where 2012 left off. And he's been very strong. He's been very effective. And the most impressive thing maybe is that he's able to work deep into games. He's going, you know, not just seven innings. He's going eight innings and sometimes nine. You know, I think 14 times this season he's gone eight innings and allowed two earned runs or less. And that's just really, really strong, especially pitching at Great American Ballpark.
There had been talk about his mechanics, that he created some of the physical issues he'd had, you know, with a delivery that's somewhat unorthodox and kind of his own personal delivery. In the end, do you think did he wind up making some changes, or do you think it's just kind of back to this is the way he throws and it works for him?
I think it's the latter. It was funny, for in spring training there was all this discussion both with the manager and with Johnny that some modification of his delivery was going to come. And although they didn't necessarily said that was the cause of his injury, but they also thought maybe, you know, it's a hard to repeat delivery because of the nuances of it, especially the Louis Tion style kind of, you know, spin, half spin. But when it really came down to it, I think the first game of the season, you pretty much saw it right there like it always was. And I didn't really see much modification. And he's just been really strong, really good, and he's just not afraid to compete and go for it.
Okay, now I'm going to ask you a tricky question, and I understand that the Reds are going to be up against it financially this off season, double figure arbitration eligibles, and an expensive starting rotation to keep together. So it's a pie in the sky question to begin with. But when you look at the team, I mean, it looks like balanced, and the parts should add up to more than they did this year. And a healthy Joey Votto is not an answer to my question. You can't go there because that's the easy one. But if you could just magically add something to this Reds team, what do you think the one piece that would make the most difference would be?
I think they need a run producing left fielder that can get on base, which is kind of asking for a lot. They need someone that is good, even if he is a power hitter that strikes out a lot, but somebody that can get on base, whether it's drawing walks or doing whatever it takes, but also that can kind of, you know, drive in some runs from the middle of the order. That's something they really don't have. They were hoping to get it more from Ryan Ludwig this year. He 2 years ago, he was so good. Last year, he lost most of the year because of his shoulder, and this year, he didn't really get it all the way back. And I think they really need someone that can do that. They lost a lot of on-base percentage going from Shin-Soo Choo to Billy Hamilton. As good as things that Hamilton did, the one thing he didn't do very well was drawing walks. And it's really, when you're going from a guy that's going from 435 on-base, plus Joey Votto is in, 435 or in that area, and then you have guys that are 300 or less, you're losing a lot of opportunities to drive in runs, and that's something that they really lack. And I think if they can get some offense, however they get it, it'll probably have to be through the trade, because I doubt they'll be able to do it on the open market and free agency, but they need to bring in another bat.
And speaking of Billy Hamilton, it seemed maybe because of the Red struggles and, you know, maybe his second half not quite what his first half was, but that there was less buzz about Billy Hamilton toward the end of the year. He still seems to me like a very strong rookie of the year candidate. As a matter of fact, I happen to have a vote in that award, and
You look at the starting pitchers. A lot of talk about Jacob DeGrom, but I don't know if there's really a super. You know, to me, there's no obvious candidate. You think Billy Hamilton could still wind up winning the Rookie of the Year?
I think he could. I looking at the list of who's out there, and the three that only stand out to me are Hamilton, DeGrom, and Colton Wong in St. Louis. And you know, especially with Hamilton, he's done it all season. Even though he has tailed off, but he has done a lot of things, and he leads in the offensive side of things almost every category other than home runs and RBIs among rookies. He's pretty much up there in all the statistics. He's almost stolen 60 bases. He has provided a lift, and what doesn't show up in the statistics is the really good defense he's played out in center field. He's played Gold Glove level defense out there. He's got 10 assists. He just had one on Tuesday night against the Brewers. So I think he does a lot of things. With DeGrom, the one thing, you know, as good as his numbers have been, he's only had like 24 starts, and he's missed some time, I think, on the DL. Obviously, he's been shut down for maybe his last two starts of this year. So I it's going to be tough. I would not be shocked if it comes down to those two, and I really couldn't say who's going to win. It sounds like, just reading all the what I've read so far, that DeGrom right now may have the edge.
Yeah, it seems pretty split. I'm going to have to get my ballot turned in by Sunday, and chances are, I think I'm leaning toward Hamilton. I do like the guy that's played, done it all year. We touched on this a little bit last week, and I'm sure around the Reds it gets touched on often. But a team that's bumping up against its payroll and does have that deep starting rotation, what's your expectation for a trade of a pitcher? Would you say it's 50-50, or is it better than 50-50 that one of those arms in the top of the rotation will get traded?
I think it's probably 50-ish, 50-50. I think what it's going to come down to is do they feel with what they have in place right now, plus maybe adding a bat if they can, do they have what it takes to overtake the big three of the division, Milwaukee, St. Louis, and Pittsburgh, no particular order? If they feel like that they're not even close, then they need to really upgrade, retool, repower, they might make some trades. I think the problem is that they have four starters a year away from free agency. Johnny Cueto, a $10 million club option for 2015, is a bargain for obviously what we just discussed, the year he's had. I see them obviously picking that up. Now the question is, do they trade Cueto, or do they maybe trade Matt Latos, even though he's had an injury-shortened year? Teams maybe express interest in him. Is Mike Leake a candidate of sorts, of someone that might want, because he's a dependable pitcher, even though he doesn't have the gaudy numbers, he does make every start. So it's going to be interesting to see what they do. I don't see them in a situation where they could retain Leake, Cueto, and Latos all long-term. I just don't see it. They already have Homer Bailey locked up for 6 years, $105 million, and it's just, with their limitations, they have nine guys owed $71 million next season. And, they have a payroll of about $100 million. They really don't have a lot of wiggle room.
Well, as the Major League season wraps up, the Arizona Fall League getting ready to get underway. And when you look at the players the Reds are sending out there, are there one or two who jump up that you're just interested to see how they handle that higher level? It's pretty high level of competition out there in the desert.
Yeah, the one that really sticks out is just because he was our first-round pick this past summer is Nick Howard out of the University of Virginia. He went to Dayton after being selected, and he's got a big power arm, and he's obviously going to be facing a competition that may be a little bit higher than the lower Class A level, and I'd be curious to see how he fares. This is kind of the same thing they did last year when they sent they sent Michael Lorenzen out to the Fall League, even though they wanted to make him a starter and have him learn that. And that was kind of why they did it. And in years past, I think they sent Robert Stevenson, another first-round pick. And it's doing for all those guys so far. It seems to have served them pretty well. So I think with Howard, it could be productive for him, and it could kind of maybe accelerate his growth.
Very interesting. Mark, we do appreciate it. For Mark Sheldon, this has been Phil Rogers. This is the Cincinnati Reds edition of MLB.com Extras. As always, we'll be joined by Kerry Muscat, beat writer for the Chicago Cubs. And the Cubs have just come off of their final video-free homestand at Wrigley Field, the last of 2014, and some major changes anticipated at Wrigley Field. Construction ongoing. I mean, we saw work being done around Wrigley Field late in the season, and seems full speed ahead for the video board for 2015. Kerry, how much different do you think the ballpark will be and will feel like when the season starts in 2015?
Well, I think fans will notice the difference significantly because it's not just the video scoreboard that's going up in left field, but the Cubs actually plan on having 7 outfield signs. They call them see-through signs. I think most fans know them, like if it's just like a Budweiser logo, you know, and you can just see the script of the Budweiser logo and go through that. It's not, but they're actually projecting 7 of those signs, the video scoreboard plus 7 signs around the rim of the outfield, and I think it'll look very different. They're supposed to start construction as soon as the regular season is over. There will be an official groundbreaking once they figure out when Mayor Rahm Emanuel can stop by to grab a shovel and put on a hard hat and dig in. But right now, if fans have been driving around the ballpark, a lot of that work that's been going on is actually the city of Chicago prepping the area before the Cubs kind of take over. So it's the Cubs really haven't officially started. It's been the city kind of getting the utility work done. But it'll be different. I guess I'm nostalgic. I'm not a big fan of video scoreboards because I don't like some of the things that other teams do. I find them very loud and distracting. But then again, I also know fans like the replays and they like being able to see some of the stats up there. And I'm sure that once it's up, I'm sure it'll be a great thing.
Well, and you know, one thing that teams certainly like is the revenue that those kind of scoreboards and advertising brings in. And, you know, not that the Cubs have really lacked for payroll. They brought down the payroll, but normally, you know, it seems to me like that's more a function of having the youngest team in the major leagues and looking at so many young players the last few years. But I'm wondering, Kerry, if you think with all this coming online in 2015, is it reasonable for fans to expect that there will be some implications on the payroll going forward, that they will have a little bit more to spend in the off season and be a little more active?
Well, I think you're going to hear the Cubs' name mentioned quite a bit in terms of being linked to some of the free agent pitchers that'll be available. And I wouldn't be surprised if they do go out and really kick the tires on some of these guys and try and decide what they want to do. The kids are still developing, and I think 2015 is still going to be a lot more. There will be what Rick Renneria likes to call the hiccups. There's going to be some ups and downs with this group because they're still kids. I think what Hoyer and Theo Epstein have also mentioned quite a bit recently is one of the things they want to add are players that can act as mentors and kind of help guide these kids. You know, players like a Justin Ruggiano, who they had, players like a Carlos Villanueva, those kind of guys. They want to make sure that there's a nice blend between the old and the new on the roster.
Well, speaking of Theo Epstein, Jed Hoyer, they're wrapping up their third year with the Cubs. And these are guys, one of them told me when they were coming to the Cubs that in Boston, the expectation or the planning every winter was being done to win 95 games a year. And over the last 3 years, the Cubs' winning percentage, .409, which over a full season plays out to 96 losses a year. So, you know, I guess the old Judy Collins song, looked at life from both sides now. But just how do you think, I don't think we step back and look at this, how difficult do you think it's been personally on Theo Epstein, Jed Hoyer, Jason McLeod to find the patience to kind of improve such a little bit at a time?
I don't think it's been tough for them personally because I think they came into this. They're probably the ones that have had the easier time personally than the fans because they came into this knowing what their plan was. They came into this knowing how long, that it was going to take some time, knowing that not all of these prospects are going to develop. They came into this probably more realistic than any fan that's been watching this. I mean, I still get emails and correspondence from fans that are upset. You know, what are they doing up there? Well, if you don't know what they're doing by now, you haven't been paying attention. You know, it's going to take some time. You know, you just have to be patient. And again, there's no guarantee that any of these top prospects are gonna be, you know, the superstars of the future. We had Addison Russell was in town recently to undergo a physical in preparation for the fall league. And you look at him, this kid's just like, I mean, just he's just a great looking athlete. He's got tons of talent, but who knows what's going to happen down the road? You know, it's just that's the risk they have to take, and that's the gamble that they're willing to take.
Jerry, looking at the start of the Epstein era, 61 wins the first year, 66 the second, and we're talking now before the season's over, but on track for another improvement of 5 or 6 wins in the third year, getting up into the low 70s. If I told you they're going to improve by at least 10 games next year and have a winning record, would you tell me I'm too optimistic, that there's no given that they're at a point where they're going to be a 500 team next year?
Yeah, I don't think, to me, I think that's very doable. A lot of it will depend on the pitching. Really, the funny thing is their pitching has actually been better than their hitting. You know, a lot of it will depend on the pitching. You know, can Jake Arrieta follow through? Can Edwin Jackson kind of get it back on track? I mean, who are they going to get to complement them? If they find the right pieces, yeah, they could easily be a 500 team next year.
Yeah, you mentioned earlier Carlos Villanueva, who and I'm sure I'm mispronouncing his last name as I habitually do, signed a $10 million contract for 2 years a couple years ago, $5 million a year. And it seems to me like he has been the least selfish big leaguer I've ever seen in accepting kind of a role as a swing man and just kind of being a guy that's kind of helped in any way he can, propping up the bullpen and just doing it. And I'm just wondering, assuming this is the end of his stay with the Cubs, how will you look back at the legacy he leaves behind?
For Villanueva? Villa to me is I'm hoping they bring him back. I keep joking with him that I'm going to be his agent and work on his contract, because he's just such an integral part of this team in terms of his mentorship. He's just the number one guy down there. He's helped so many guys. I'm not sure if Theo and Jed listen to this, but hopefully they pay attention and they figure out some way to bring him back.
Yeah, his attitude just seems to me off the charts, that he's never really been given that much of a chance to fill in. Other guys have gotten the good opportunities, and he's just made the most of it. And really, when you look at our world, Kerry, what else can we do but make the most of the chances we get? It's been a pleasure doing the podcast with you throughout the regular season, and thanks very much. That's been the NL Central edition of MLB.com Extras. This is Phil Rogers. Thanks for listening.